Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card, offering Ireland's first personalised lending rates.
Time for Tell Me Why with Graeme Finlay. If you have a question for Graeme, you can send it in as ever to afternoon@newstalk.com. Today's question, why do people think tradition is so important? Graeme, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We do tend to, culturally, we treasure traditions.
We do and we don't. I mean, one of the interesting things about this question is that it has both a psychological question about what makes us feel good, what's important to us, and how it might work psychologically. Mm. But then there's also the sort of philosophical question, which has taken a really profound look at tradition over the last few centuries. And it's, you know, to see it as something more than just a psychological phenomenon. So tradition is from tradere, which means in Latin to hand over.
Right.
And in fact, we've talked about superstitions before and rituals and traditions a lot like that. And there's a psychological experiment specifically about tradition where, and it turns out, this they think it's not the hope for a reward or just feeling like it. It's when you fear a punishment that you start up a tradition. And so they threatened people. They said, if you make the wrong choice between A and B, and these were two pictures, you'll get an electric shock. Mm. Now, apparently they didn't shock anybody, which is kind of less fun, really.
Yes. Frankly. But,
they then, before they let the people choose, though, they showed someone a video. And they showed all the people a video. In all of the videos, the person chose A. So these people, even though they didn't get shocked in response, chose 95% of them chose A.
Right. Okay.
And so then they went and tried to see if it could be handed over, handed down through generations. And so they showed another group of people the videos of the first generation, as it were, of people who chose A and didn't suggest that they'd shock them or not. And 95% of those people chose A.
Yes.
So they think that this shows something about social learning and about how we're a lot like animals and that we're going to learn something even if we don't have a particularly good rational reason for it, simply maybe because we're afraid of predators or of some kind of bad thing happening to us, right? And it's this irrational quality to prejudice, which may be behind the question, and then again, it may not be. But the questioner may be asking, you know, why are people so attached to tradition when there's absolutely no rational basis for it?
Yeah, but we somehow assign worth to tradition.
We do. I mean, and it's important to us. I mean, it can be very, very comforting. It can give us, meaning in our lives and all this kind of. So I was researching the psychology of tradition, and a lot of it was this kind of pop psychology. It's like Anna Tevka, tradition, Fiddler on the Roof stuff, and, you know, about tradition is something which people find reassuring, especially if things are changing in their society.
Yeah.
But philosophers have actually had a lot to say about tradition. In many ways, it encapsulates the political debates of the last several hundred years. And it's really, really interesting how this works. Because if you think of tradition as people just doing the same thing over and over again for no reason, right, but simply maybe because of the dumbest instincts, which are ultimately fundamentally irrational, right, you may feel the same way about prejudice, which is, as Voltaire said, having an opinion without judgment. Right? Mm. So you just have the opinion for no reason at all, right?
Yeah.
And Voltaire was against it, right? That's because Voltaire was a quintessential Enlightenment figure who believed, I mean, the Enlightenment is, this is really crude, but, you know, the Enlightenment was a whole movement focused on progress through the use of reason, including the scientific method, so that we could establish universal principles like the laws of physics. We could, you know, find out what is really true about humans, what makes them happy, and eventually we could apply these through reforming projects to completely rebuild our society in a way which makes us all a lot happier and doesn't have the kind of things which Voltaire thought were really bad and made people unhappy for no good reason, like the church.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. So the Enlightenment was essentially a reaction to a tradition, to the Christian tradition.
It was. I mean, and one of the interesting things is, I mean, tradition only becomes a sort of bad thing if you start thinking about it in this particular way. And so, I mean, this is a grotesque caricature of the Enlightenment because, you know, many people who we'd see as Enlightenment figures or founding the Enlightenment, like Newton, were very religious people. Mm. And even as sort of crude thinkers like D'Holbach, who just really thought you could reduce human beings to a mechanism and then make them happy, were saying stuff like that, their fellow Enlightenment figures a little later on, like Hume and Smith, we're showing all the ways in which, you know, and often Hume was quite conservative, right? You know, we don't actually know what we're doing. And all these principles of psychology don't necessarily track the real world. And so you start getting these battles between people who we'll call empiricists, who think that knowledge is based on the senses, but accordingly is problematic and we have to be careful and we don't want to make any grandiose claims, and rationalists who think that there's an order out there which can be discovered and is independent of the process of knowing it, right? So this ultimately, not surprisingly, because politics is involved, comes down to real hard politics. And people saw the French Revolution in many, many ways as an attempt to just, on the basis of rational principles, the universal rights of man and citizen, tear down all that traditional stuff, which is totally irrational and serves the interests of the powerful, and build out of whole cloth a whole new edifice of society. Mm. And so the greatest, arguably, Irish political theorist, Edmund Burke, famously prophesied that this would end in tears and also the lopping off of heads.
And he was kind of right.
As everything was destroyed, but you had the flimsiest sort of principles to build the society on, that the sort of shallow knowledge or the sort of truncated knowledge, which doesn't have any relationship to people's lived human experience, and what the ages have produced in the form of tradition and inherited institutions, that the new liberal knowledge, which was learned yesterday by someone writing a textbook of economics or moral science, wasn't enough, and that the traditional institutions, the traditional ways of thinking, the traditional sentiments, the opinions, the prejudices, which might not be established ex nihilo from a universal space of reasoning, that those were valuable achievements and should not be gotten rid of so quickly, because the end is sort of extremely tyrannical disaster. And so he rehabilitates the notion of tradition as something living and important, which we are born into, right? So he says, yes, society is based on a social contract, but not just between the living, but between the dead and also those who are yet to be born. Right, the living, the dead, and those who are yet to be born. That's a tradition. It's being handed on through. And so various contemporary philosophers, I mean, this brings it up to nowadays. I mean, John Rawls in 1971 issued a theory of justice where he got rid of, as a way of us getting our moral tuition straight, all of the identities which we would have and bring to a social contract through what he calls the veil of ignorance. Imagine you didn't know who you were going to be in the new society. Mm. And a lot of people who we called communitarians back then, they never liked that for whatever reason, did point out, like Alistair MacIntyre or Michael Sandel, that we were born into communities. We weren't these people who didn't know what our identities were, but we were born into traditions. We were born into communities. We were born into families. We were born into cultures. We were born into, all sorts of things which we didn't choose, right? And so some people out there, and again, think about your own views about this. I think most of us feel some of the intuitions on both sides that we didn't choose, but that nevertheless, to some extent, constitute who we are.
Whether we like it or
define,
not.
Yeah. Exactly, and define who we are, and to some sense bring us comfort, right? But in a lot of lots of ways might, makes us sort of anxious, right? Think about how you feel about your family, right? and so MacIntyre's point was that, we're born into traditions, but, traditions are not just doing the same damn thing over and over again. Right. Traditions can change and innovate, not as much as some other stuff, but so that even reacting against a tradition, even totally rejecting it, can be part of the tradition. And so one way to get a sense of this is it does seem that if you were born and raised a Catholic and then you come to reject the Catholic Church for whatever reason, right, or specifically the Irish Catholic Church, right, you're going to have a different relationship to the Irish Catholic Church than if you're not Irish and if you've never been Catholic at all. Mm-hmm. Right. With this idea that we're, traditions aren't just something we can scrutinize from a rational point of view, but are really something which makes human life possible, we end up with quite a profound notion of tradition, which leads, on the other hand, to all sorts of different problems, right? Now, so there's this great theorist called Hans-Georg Gadamer, who really sees being born into tradition and having certain prejudices, he tries to sort of rehabilitate these words, right, as the basis for us having meaningful lives. We can't even understand ourselves. We can't even ask ourselves questions about what we want to be without the resources which a tradition provides us.
Mm. Right? Whether we accept that tradition or reject it all or in something in between.
Exactly. So, I mean, again, and rejecting it can be within the tradition. Now, here's the problem. First of all, the suggestion is you can't get outside a tradition, right? That you're always going to be in the tradition, even if you jump on it and set it on fire, mm-hmm. right? You know, ideally do that in that order. Whereas, you know, we have societies where there are lots of rival traditions. And that's one of the problems which I think Gadamer confronts in his work, McIntyre confronts in his work, and all of us are probably confronting in many of our lives, because many of us may inherit multiple traditions.
Yeah.
We certainly will have to live in a society with people with different traditions. How do we talk to each other, right? Mm. It's hard enough to talk to people within your tradition. I mean, one of the sort of stereotypes of the Catholic Church is everyone just does what the Pope says, like robots, right? But of course—
That's not true,
Well, not only do people not even do what he says, but, but you know, the Catholic Church, and you know, I'm not here to spin for the Catholic Church. It's not even my tradition, if you want to know a secret. But there are debates. You know, the history of the church is in many ways a history of debates going on within the church, of various types of ferocity, using a set of common terms, but also, you know, disagreeing over terms and so forth. But in a multicultural society or a multi-tradition society or a society where we're constantly crisscrossing with traditions, where we're exposed to traditions from around the world, I mean, all my religious studies textbooks from when I was a student, you know, about the Buddhist tradition, the Jewish tradition, et cetera, you know, all of these traditions, the worry is that is the one of relativism, that we're, you know, if traditions are so darn important to us, metaphysically, epistemologically, ontologically, and morally, right, you know, how do we communicate? How do we really relate to other people?
Mm.
And in many ways, that's a political problem. We have to come up with a society where people can talk to each other. But if you take the sort of super liberal, stripped down view that everyone has their opinions and they should be free to air them, and we should have a society where we're free to have all these discussions, and yet we don't want to force any traditions on any people, well, then you're going to have a different kind of society than if you think that people's traditions are important and we should recognize the importance for people, why people are so attached to them, in the words of the questioner, and enable that, right? And that's going to lead to very, very different answers, for example, about how patronage of primary schools should be in Ireland.
Right. Or indeed about, it throws up all sorts of questions in particular, and it seems particularly relevant to a lot of the discussions that are taking place around Europe today about immigrants and about refugees and about European culture, and that European culture, whatever that is under some degree of threat from people coming in from the outside.
And that's the thing. I mean, and this, you know, this is the kind of concern which can be reasonably thrown up by this tradition talk, right? One of the important things is when people talk about European culture, all of the philosophical arguments I've just been talking about are in European culture,
yes. Right? I mean, well, it's a strange contradiction that people say European culture is under threat, not understanding that European culture actually would be throwing open its arms to people coming in from outside.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, I mean, European culture has internalized traditions from all over, as far as Buddhism in the 19th century and Islam far earlier than that, right? So from the Middle Ages on and so forth. So what we're seeing is a sort of dialogue. And I guess maybe if you're prone to sort of epistemological dread, you know, the theory of knowledge, you're dreading that you can never know anything or communicate to anybody, you know, it might seem a good example of what Gadamer calls the fusion of horizons, where people can communicate to each other because these debates between people who often believe quite different things have been going on in Europe, in individual countries and in individual traditions for a very long time. And we're not just shouting at each other. And so it's a really interesting question about how you diagnose sort of modern society right up to now, where people are having freedom of speech discussions and things like that. I mean, and one difficult question this guy Alistair MacIntyre poses is, like, Nietzsche or Aristotle? Aristotle believed that human beings had a purpose, that they are largely biological sorts of things, but with reason, crucially, and we are destined to be a certain kind of fully flourishing individual of a very particular sort. We're not going to become a cabbage, or we're not going to be addicted to something. We're not going to just sit around and do X all day. And if we're women, we're not going to do much at all except, you know, listen to our betters, which are men. Yeah. But, you know, and so he's prepared to take on board a whole lot of conservative Greek middle class 4th century tradition, right? He thinks the choice is between reaffirming some kind of vision of the good life, which might have highly particular cultural characteristics, and just being a sort of a nihilist, or you know, reducing everything to sort of "I say so." Right? And so it's Nietzsche, which is a terrible way to talk about Nietzsche. It's really not doing a service to Nietzsche. But Nietzsche's awareness, I mean, what he takes on board is Nietzsche, you know, the great 19th century German thinker, you know, the idea that we construct our own reality, we construct our own identity, and we don't do so just for kicks. We do so as part of our will to power, as our way of asserting ourselves in the world, of you know, and often getting it over on other people.
Mm.
So, I mean, I often think that Nietzsche is maybe, as opposed to Marx, and I won't refer to he who may, must not be named at this point, you know, as the basis of modern identity politics. And Nietzsche was very conservative, but because he's the one who talks about how words do things, and accordingly, right, if you are undermining my identity, right? You're threatening me in some kind of way, right? And I should be allowed to say who I am, and I should be allowed to construct my own identity. And strong people do that, and weak people get their identities handed to them. And that, you know, that I think you can see how this could lead to a certain kind of identity politics. And so I don't think we have to take what McIntyre says on board. I'm not a McIntyrean. But we do have to, I mean, get back down to sort of brass tacks. We have to think, you know, who am I, right? What's important to me? Why is it important to me? But you don't have to turn that into a sense that, you know, I have to rethink everything, question everything, reject my entire past to find out who I really am. But we work with what we've got and we try to make it a little bit better. But then we have to work in a society with lots of other people who are also asking the same questions and try and make society work a little better.
In a liberal democracy, for as long as they still exist, and in multicultural liberal democracies, is there an underlying tradition that binds our societies together, or is it a set of principles?
That is a great question, and there's a whole other discussion to be had about that. So there's the liberal tradition, and yet the liberal tradition is a multifarious tradition just like any other one. Some of it, like Voltaire and the enlightened despots of the 18th century, isn't very democratic, right? And some of it is democratic and sees these liberal freedoms as crucial to a democracy. Some of it's libertarian and doesn't think that sort of the democracy has an awful lot to do because the government shouldn't be empowered to do any of the things redistributive people want to do. So it's also a complex tradition. But when it comes back down to it, it's another question about legitimacy, right? You know, what is patriotism a virtue is another question which McIntyre asks in another paper, which is, you know, we liberals are very leery of the idea of patriotism, according to conservatives, because they don't like the sort of passions and particularity and the attachment to the nation which that involves, because it seems to them like it's irrational, right? Liberals often deny that they're totally against patriotism, but they're against blind patriotism. But at the same time, some liberals like Jürgen Habermas say we should talk about constitutional patriotism. We should be patriotic about our constitution and our principles, which are, to some extent, very, very abstract, right? And to a conservative, that doesn't seem like the real deal, right, to patriotism. It's like, I'm absolutely patriotic about our traffic laws, right? You know, whereas as opposed to I'm patriotic because I'm an Irishman, right, who is born of this soil and, you know,
yeah, but then we're
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Moving towards ethno-nationalism.
Right, and ethno-nationalism is, I mean, there are ways to lose the plot on both sides. But I hope if we learn from this that we need to talk to each other, we'll be able to keep it in bounds.
Graham, thanks a million for coming into us. Graham Finley there.